MacCast, Tuesday, October 25th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the show. Hey, I got a little bit of a different show for you today because I am a bit behind. I was out of town last week at a conference, so I'm playing catch up on the show prep a little bit, trying to process all the emails that I missed when I was out. Isn't that the way it always goes? Anytime you go out of town for anything, I was out of town for work, so I, you know, it wasn't like I was just slacking off. It wasn't a vacation or anything like that, although, you know, it's nice to get out for vacation too. But either way, when you go out and do those sorts of things, stuff kind of piles up. And it got even worse because this conference, for whatever reason, it was a tech programming conference, but they didn't have Wi-Fi. So I wasn't able to check email and catch up on things. But luckily, I had a chance to sit down and talk with David Sparks. And actually, one of the things that had happened was, if you remember a couple weeks ago, I went up for the Mac Computer Expo and gave a talk up there. I already put out the audio for you from the keynote, but I had given a session on using your iPad beyond web and email. The concept being using your iPad for actually getting real work done. And I am finding more and more that for certain tasks and for certain things, I'm using my iPad. And I'm constantly surprised how much more usefulness and real work I'm getting out of my iPad as I learn to use the device and as I sort of let go of some preconceived ideas about how I work and my workflows and stuff like that. So I wanted to cover some of that stuff and talk about it in an episode. Well, about the same time I was getting ready for that talk, David Sparks was getting ready to launch his new book called iPad at Work, which covers a lot of these same sorts of topics. So I thought this would be a great opportunity to sit down with David, talk to him about the new book, and just have a conversation about some of the things I'm using my iPad for in terms of getting actual work done and creating documents and things like that, and find out some of his tips and tricks and things. So we cover apps, we cover all kinds of little workflows and things that we've discovered, and I hope you find it incredibly useful. I know I did in just even talking with David. So we're going to get into that in this episode. Before I get started, though, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors. Speaking of workflows and productivity, it's Smile, Smile Software. And today I want to talk to you about Text Expander, which is just an application that has become critical for any installation of Mac OS X that I have. It's almost like I feel like it's part of the operating system, but it's from Smile. And the reason is because it saves me time. It also helps me get work done. It increases my productivity. And what you can do with it is you can take any kind of text that you may need to type out and that is reused. And I use it in my coding. I use it in answering emails. And very often, what I find is I have to type kind of the same thing over and over again. There's a lot of common questions that I get on the MacCast, for example. So I have text expander snippets for that sort of thing. My email signatures, I have different variations of email signatures I want to use. So I have a bunch of those set up in text expander. So let me just use that as an example. So if I'm answering an email, it doesn't matter what account I'm in, what account I'm replying from, I have little snippets and they're SIG1, you know, it's just typing SIG1, SIG2, SIG3, and I know what those signatures are. And just by typing that, because I have Text Expander installed on my Mac, wherever I am, it will automatically expand out and type out a full signature with URLs, with phone numbers, with addresses, whatever is assigned to that little snippet. And you can do this throughout the operating system. It's really great, too, because they have some predefined snippets that you can actually just download from Text Expander. They have some really great little groups for doing things like accented words. So it can do text replacement. So if you type the non-accented version of a word and you have this little snippet library or group enabled, it will add in all of the accents for you. Another great one that I use is they have one for CSS and HTML. So I can type a little shortcut and it will automatically expand out the full HTML sort of skeleton framework that I need to work with and insert the cursor in the right position. They have ones for filling out forms. It's Apple scriptable. It's super powerful when you start diving into it. And it's just a great application. So if you haven't checked it out, you should do that. You should head over to smilesoftware.com. And don't forget right now, if you want to pick up another one of their products, PDF Pen or PDF Pen Pro, there is a discount coupon for MacCast listeners, exclusive. You get 20% off PDF Pen or PDF Pen Pro, the full versions, and that includes the family packs and the office packs. You can go to smilesoftware.com/MacCast for the details on that, or just head to Smile Software to check out Text Expander and Disk Label and the other great products that they sell. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So what do you say we jump into finding out a little bit more about our iPads and how we can use those to do a little bit more than just kind of surf the web and play games and do email, to actually dive in and use it for work and find out some of the tips and tricks for kind of replacing, or not replacing, you can't really replace a desktop or a notebook yet, but I think you can find uses for your iPad that go way beyond maybe some of the things that you're currently using it for. And really, there's no better person to talk with that about than David Sparks from Mac Power Users. He is a lawyer, and he has been using his iPad to supplement what he does in his job for a while now. So definitely an expert, and it was great to be able to sit down and talk with him. So here's my conversation with David. Well, Mr. Sparks, welcome back to the MacCast. How are you doing?
Very well, Mr. Christensen. Very well. Thank you.
David Sparks from Mac Power Users. Glad to have you back on the show. I guess you're half the Mac Power Users team, right?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, you do that with Katie Floyd. And first, you know, congratulations on the whole 5x5 thing, too.
Yeah, it's really awesome.
You guys are new members of the 5x5 network, which is just one of the most awesome They have a lot of shows on the network. I can't keep up. So have they moved beyond the kind of tech realm?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, they've got like the Incomparable podcast, which is really kind of cool. It's like science fiction stuff.
Yeah, so they're like breaking out and bringing on new shows. And it was great, you know, to see you get on board with them, because that's a great network. So really a lot of fun. So people should check your show out there. But I wanted to get you on this time because we had you on the last time you put out a book. You had your Mac at Work book, which did very, very well. And you're back with a new one, iPad at Work, right?
Yes. I'm like a bad penny. I just don't go away.
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of people that are taking iPads to the office, right?
Yeah, you know, actually this book has been out a little while now, and it's been like doing gangbusters. It was number one in the iBookstore computer category for 2 weeks, which kind of blew me away, to be honest.
Yeah, so I had a chance to look through it. It's great stuff in there. And I was thinking that a number of people had asked me at Mac Computer Expo, you were there as well. We were both speaking, and we did the keynote presentation, which I put out for the MacCast listeners. But while we were there, I was also doing a session that was very, I think, similar to a lot of the stuff that's covered in your book. And a lot of my audience has asked me to kind of, if I was going to roll through some of the information that was in that presentation. So I thought this would be a great opportunity for us to just chat about sort of the iPad in general and people kind of taking it beyond its core use. So the theme for my discussion at MCE was iPad beyond web and email. And I think iPad at Work is exactly in that same kind of realm. It's getting beyond this idea that, oh, I'm going to get an iPad because all I do is web and email. And yeah. I get that a lot. I don't know if you've heard people say that to you often.
Yeah, well, and it kind of goes back to the whole thing about it being just a content consumption device.
Right. You
know, that's the usual dig when someone wants to make fun of your iPad. Well, that's great for reading, but you can't really do work on it.
Yeah, and I think there are some things that you can do to actually use it to get work done. I find I'm using it more and more to get quote-unquote real work done. And it seems so weird to say that, because it's like from the very beginning, I used it for getting work done, right? I mean, starting with the iPad 1, even though people were saying it was that whole content consumption device.
That's kind of interesting. I was just reading the Steve Jobs biography, and I know that he got really kind of personally offended by that dig. And
oh, really?
That was one of the big points when they came out with the 2, is he put a lot of resources into putting, you know, GarageBand and iMovie to prove that you can do more than read the web with it.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I don't have the book yet. I have it on order. I'm a little miffed, actually, at Amazon about that whole thing.
I got an iBookstore, so I've been doing that more often. I figured, you know, it seemed appropriate. I think Steve would approve, right?
Well, my thing is I you know, for that significant of a book, I want to kind of have the physical thing, which I think goes back to, you know, I love digital books. I have a bunch of iBooks and that sort of thing. But I think it's my same feeling with like DVDs or Blu-rays or whatever. I don't have a Blu-ray player, so I do the DVD thing. But there's certain films that I kind of want to have that physical sort of collection. And that book to me was kind of one of those. What was odd to me, and I was talking to somebody about this today, is that on DVD you now have kind of what they call the combo pack or whatever on Blu-ray, or the digital copy, I guess, is the bigger equivalent. And I don't know why there wasn't an option on Amazon for me to get the book as a physical thing plus Kindle, but at a discounted price. You know, so if I wanted to buy those two, I'd have to pay $17.99 for the hardcover book and another $16.99 for the Kindle edition. I totally would have paid $25, $26 to have both.
I suspect that has more to do with the book publisher than Amazon, though.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, but it's just...
They haven't got there yet.
It's just silly because it would be pure profit on the digital side, right? Or almost pure profit.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't cost them any to run off another copy of the digital version.
Yeah, after you've already paid.
A little bit of bandwidth and what have you, but...
Yeah. It's kind of interesting. I don't know if this is true or not. With my first book, there was about, I think, about $4 difference between the digital and the hard copy price. Yep. And that's true, I think, with the current one, which is, I think, $17.
It's a penny digital. Different. And, or 99 cents different, excuse me.
Yeah. Well, I was told by someone at my publisher that it costs $3 or $4 to print a full color 300-page book. And, you know, by the time you do the printing, the shipping, and all the stuff involved, it was like $3 or $4. So that's how they explain the difference. But, you know, I really don't know. I mean, I don't have
well, like I said, it doesn't hold up with Steve Jobs' book. Because it's $17.99 versus $16.99. Anyway, I digress. Yeah. I didn't want to get into that whole topic. But
to get back to the point, Steve also felt that, you know, hey, this thing can do more than just read the web and check mail.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, sort of my take as I was thinking about this for my talk and talk about how you go into this in the book maybe, but you know, I think the problem is that people want to think of the iPad to a certain degree like a computer when they try to think about it beyond web and email. So it's like, you know, not trying to force the preconceptions about what a computer or a notebook or a laptop is onto the iPad as a device. And so my take was sort of the first thing you need to do to get kind of over this thought process about it. One, either only being some sort of tablet device or not being a computer, or looking at it as it's a computer, and then you immediately become disappointed because it's really not. Does that make sense?
I just got an email today from someone that was upset with me. They're like, dude, this thing really sucks. It doesn't track changes, dude. You know?
And so I distilled that down into, well, you really need to leverage the strengths of the device rather than trying to focus on its deficiencies when it's held up against a computer or a laptop or something like that.
I think it's different.
Yeah.
It's a new platform. And some of the stuff that works with a nice big screen and a keyboard doesn't necessarily work on an iPad. And probably more importantly, some of the stuff that works on a computer with a much faster processor and bigger battery isn't there yet on the iPad. The track changes thing is one of the, I think, shortfalls with the iPad as a lawyer. You know, I write and I do track changes. So I can't do that on the iPad. So that's one part of my job that an iPad isn't sufficient for.
But let me ask. Yeah, sorry.
It's really a function of the fact that the software is not there yet, and the processing is not quite there yet. This is a brand new device. Give it a couple of years. I have no doubt that track changes is going to work just fine, probably within a year or two of this recording. But there are other things like mind mapping and planning and stuff that work really good on the iPad, much better than they work on the Mac. So you just have to look at the, you know, it's like your toolbox. You know, you use a screwdriver for some things and use a wrench for other things and use a hammer for other things. And the fact that you add a wrench doesn't make your hammer any less valuable. And if you're a smart carpenter, you'll use each one appropriately.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about, I mean, have you found sort of a workaround or something to do on the iPad so that you can maybe pseudo do a track changes? Or, I mean, that's the other thing is you can kind of make it work. Maybe that's not ideal and maybe that's not what we want to talk about in this conversation, but I think I've found myself doing some of those sorts of things.
Well, this is a good example. Track changes is an issue. Because my day job, I'm an attorney, and we exchange contracts, and every attorney in the world has Microsoft Word etched into his retina that right. That's the place you do this stuff with. And Pages on the Mac tracks changes just fine, and it works okay with Word. Not perfectly, but it works good enough usually. But it doesn't work on the Mac yet. On the iPad yet. And so there really is no solution. When I write articles for Macworld as well, and Macworld does everything in Markdown. And the way we track changes on my articles with Macworld is my editor puts a bracket and puts a comment in after anything I write saying you should emphasize this or talk about this or what about this. And I go and make the change and delete his comment. And that's how I track changes with Macworld, and it works just fine. So it depends on who you're working with. But if you have a job where you need to track changes in complex Word documents, that's one part of your life that you're not going to solve on an iPad yet.
Right.
In fact, that's probably the biggest one, frankly.
Yeah. So one of the immediate advantages that I think that you can leverage on the iPad, and some people, again, see this as a deficiency, but I like the whole concept of single task applications as opposed Amen. To a big, complex application, right?
Amen, brother.
I mean, it's actually a good workflow. And to me, I commented on this in the presentation I was doing. It's a little bit feels like coming back to the roots of the Mac, you know, back in the old multi-finder days. You kind of had one application that you worked with. But I find it's actually somewhat helpful because you focus to a certain degree on the task at hand. Now, it goes a little beyond that. And again, back to the multi-finder analogy where you can have multiple apps open, but you're focused in working on one, but you can still switch and move between the others. So the supplement to that is you have to get really familiar, or at least I've found in my workflows that I get really familiar with cut, copy, paste. So, you know, between multi-switching and in iOS 5, it's great. And I found to force myself to use the new gesture.
Sure, the four-finger swipe.
Yeah, so I'm fine, and I'm starting to get really efficient at doing things like taking notes and doing my research for the show on my iPad because I can, you know, be working in Reader, going through articles. I can clip out bits of information, do the four-finger swipe over. I have Omni Outliner on the iPad or Notebook on the iPad open, and I'm cutting and pasting stuff between applications, right? And moving very quickly back and forth. But
I wish I'd kept track, but I wrote over half the book on the iPad. And that's a 110,000 word book. So you can do it. You know, I just, like you said, I'd swipe back and forth between the app I was writing about and a Notesy window.
So you were using Notesy?
Yeah, it's the text editors, we are very fortunate on the iPad. There are so many very good text editors. I was using Writeroom today, and it's very hard for me to just say one. But
let's say a couple. we'll give people a couple. So first, just real quickly talk about Notesy. Because I have that one on my iPad as well.
I like it because I like a fixed font, mm-hmm. right? Fixed font, because when you're writing, having a fixed font for me is an easy way to see that I have periods and commas and quotation marks and all the necessary grammatical pieces. When I've got it in a proportional spaced font, sometimes that stuff will blend in or squish in and I miss it, or I don't, it's a comma when I thought it was a period or something like that. So for the writing process, I generally regard fixed fonts as the best way to go. And Notzi uses the, what is it called? The color scheme that I like so much by the guy who worked it on me and who did, it's slipping my mind right now. We're recording this late at night, so it's been a long day. But the Solarized. I'm sorry. See, it comes. I'm old, but it gets there eventually. Solarized color scheme, which is a really nice, professionally set up color scheme, so you can have a very attractive look. And it syncs just fine with Dropbox. And I had a Scrivener project that I wrote the book out of. So Scrivener on the Mac was syncing constantly with Dropbox, and I'd open Notzi, and it would catch up with whatever I had done in Scrivener the last time I had the Mac Scrivener open. So then I'd have that on my iPad and I could continue while my car was getting the oil changed or whatever.
Cool.
I think, yeah. I rambled a little bit there, didn't
I? No. So and Notzi, you mentioned earlier that you use Markdown for your Macworld stuff, and it looks like Notzi has support for Markdown as well.
Yes, it does. But there's some, and you know, to answer your early question, there's Writeroom, I think, is very good. Writing Kit is a great Markdown text editor that just seems to get better. They have a 2.0 out now. So when I wrote the original word processing chapter, I split it up really in two pieces. I talked about traditional word processors like Pages, Documents to Go, and some of the kind of word alternatives. And the other half of it was about the idea of using a text editor on the iPad instead of a word processor, which I think is probably the best solution for a lot of people. You know, you can write the text out on your iPad and then do the layout in front of your computer.
Yeah, yeah. I use Nebulous Notes a lot. That's kind of become my default note-taking app because it has syncing with, if it's just a pure text note, I'm using that. If I have to do an outline or something a little more complex, it's either Omni Outliner or Notebook, Circus Pony's Notebook. So
yeah, those are both great apps.
Yeah. So, and I don't know. It's usually Omni Outliner if it's just a pure straight outline thing. If I need to do something a little more complex with, you know, more stuff, or I want to do a lot of annotating or something like that, then Notebook is kind of the preferred one. The only down thing on Notebook, I think, for me is not having a way to get it out other than going through iTunes, you know, to get stuff back and forth.
But, yeah, have you played with the OPML export format in Omni Outliner?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
It's really great because that is conversant with other outliners on your Mac and on your iPad.
Yeah, and I've taken stuff, you know, OPML back to Notebook to kind of flush out things, so... And that works really well.
And if you do a big project, you can take an OPML into Scrivener, which is how I did this book. I started with this massive iThoughts HD mind map, which was the genesis of this book, on my iPad. And I, you know, just filled it in for really months as I kind of researched apps and figured out what I wanted to do. And eventually that was an OPML file that went into Scrivener.
Yeah. And so...
When I stop and listen to myself, sometimes I realize I am such a nerd. You know?
Yeah, but I mean, in the course of this conversation, that's a good thing. So I think lot of what we're talking about here, though, this is a great lead-in, because the next thing I talked about in leveraging sort of the iPad's strengths is getting really familiar with the share button, right?
Yeah,
in every application. You know, share. I mean, the power when you need to start moving things and documents between different formats or exporting to different areas, the share button comes in real handy. And it, related to that for me is the apps that support the whole open with, especially for moving between applications, right?
Yeah, that really is the file system on the iPad.
Yeah. I mean, the downside of that, and you'll hear a lot of people complain, is you kind of end up with copies of things all over the place, which I don't, it's not ideal, but if we're just talking about how do I use my iPad at work, or how do I use it beyond web and email, I think that's really one of, there's a lot of power behind that button. And for those of people who don't know, you know, it's the thing that looks like a little square with an arrow jumping out of it, right?
Yeah, it's a little confusing because that's also referred to often in apps as the action button.
Yeah.
And sometimes it is used to share items, and other times it's used to open up other actions that don't involve sharing. So,
yeah, Apple uses it in like pages and stuff for like print and all that sort of thing, right? If I'm remembering properly.
Yeah. So you just need to check that out in the apps that you're excited about, and sometimes it will share, and sometimes it'll bring some other action available.
What is the Apple's official name for it, though? Is the share button, right? Or am I getting that wrong?
I believe in their human interface guidelines, they refer to it as an action button, but it's it's also often called the share. I downloaded those when I started writing the book. I wanted to get as accurate as I can when I describe that stuff, but I think the primary use is they call it an action button, but
perfect.
I mean, that's even better.
I mean, that's a better description because you're right. In many cases, it does a lot more than just share. So yeah. That's likely why Apple would term it that. So we should.
In the book was in apps where it was used as a pure share button, I called it the share button, and other ones I called it the action. So it's a little confusing, but that way the reader would know what they could do with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the kind of the other two things, and just leveraging some of the iPad strengths, I think when you start really looking at workflows and trying to get real work done on the iPad, for me, it's getting touchy-feely with the thing, learning to leverage touch and gestures within the applications that support it, because I think those things really add to your productivity. We already talked about the four-finger swipe thing in iOS 5. And then the multitasking, you know, really taking advantage of moving fluidly between apps. You know, even though you can only have one app kind of focused on at a time, which I think is still powerful, you have those occasions where you need to move between things. So, you know, doing the double tap or the four-finger swipe up, which is another new gesture, right, in iOS 5, which I'm starting to try to remember to do more, saves a lot of time.
Have you ever had a chance to play with OmniGraffle for the iPad?
You know, that's one I haven't bought. I have OmniGraffle for the desktop, and because of the price, I haven't really pulled the trigger on it. I used to do a lot more with OmniGraffle than I do now. When I was working at my last company, I'd use that for prepping almost all of my specification documents. Now I really don't have to do that as much anymore, so I didn't have an immediate need for it. But yeah, I kind of want to buy it.
It's a diagramming app. And, you know, the Omni group puts a lot of love into their iPad apps. I think they're the gold standard for iPad apps. They really spend a lot of time thinking about it. And I've always felt like, and not everybody has a need for a diagramming app, and I think it's $50 if memory serves, so it's not cheap. But if you do diagramming, it's amazing what you can do on the iPad with just your fingers. And it feels a lot like once you get that app, you know, once you understand how it works, it feels a lot like playing the piano to me. I play the piano on my, you know, my free time, and it feels like a musical instrument to me because the way you can manipulate it, it feels like something out of the future. You know?
Yeah, they always do a really nice job with their apps, for sure. So we kind of touched a little bit on the file system, but I think this is another area where people get hung up in moving from traditional desktops and then trying to see the iPad as a device for kind of doing, I hate to keep saying this, you know, quote, real work, but that's really what people say, you know, oh, I can't get real work done on that, right? So, you know, what's your take on how do people wrap their heads around the whole file system?
The complaints with
or
the
lack
file system,
of a file system, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think that the complaints with the iPad file system is a nerd complaint. I've never heard anyone that is not really technically savvy complain about the lack of a file system on the iPad. So all of us podcasters are nerds by definition, or Mac podcasters. So that's something that we're very aware of, and it's something that you read about in, you know, tech journals and, you know, people who like to, you know, program Android or whatever will complain about that. However, when you get normal people involved, they don't really have a problem with the lack of a file system, and they're flummoxed by the existence of a file system to begin with. So I don't think that's as big of a problem as it's made out to be.
Yeah.
Well, that being said, you know, Apple is trying to deal with this, with this iCloud that's coming out, and I think they're making steps, and Dropbox is a huge help. If you use the iPad to get work done, I think a Dropbox account is almost a necessity.
Right. Right. I said in my talk, the path to enlightenment is through the cloud when talking about the file system.
Yeah. Know?
And pointing to iCloud, documents in the cloud, Dropbox, you know, if you're still on mobile me, iDisk, you know, I already mentioned, you know, I use Nebulous Notes, which links right into Dropbox, so that when I make a note on my iPad and sync it with through Nebulous Notes to Dropbox, then when I get back to my Mac, hey, the same note is right there in my Dropbox folder. Right? It's synchronized.
And Dropbox is the existing stable platform for syncing. They made it ridiculously easy for app developers to plug into their system. So whatever your favorite productivity app is, most likely it has a hooks to save straight to your Dropbox storage. And right now it's the one to beat. Even iCloud really hasn't matched its utility yet.
It's free. And I think we had a rumor just this week that supposedly Apple had tried to buy Dropbox, but they didn't want to let it happen.
There was an article, I think it was Forbes magazine, with the guy who runs Dropbox, and he got invited to Steve Jobs' office. And he said that they had offered him, I want to say it's seven figures, but I'm not sure, but that they had offered a lot of money. Maybe it was nine. I don't remember. But anyway, yeah. So he was making the point that, you know, Steve Jobs offered him a bunch of money for the company. He said, no, I want to build it. And Jobs said, you don't have a product, you have a service. And good luck with that.
Right.
But so far, Dropbox has been the one to beat it. Apple has released iCloud as we record this, and I don't think it's still fully baked yet.
The whole documents in the cloud thing. But let's take a quick aside on that. I mean, so really the only thing that it's integrated with is the iWork applications at this point, right?
It's showing up in other places. GoodReader, which is a very popular PDF app now, has iCloud support. Some of the pod catchers are starting to get iCloud. So it's starting to show up. And from what I've seen of the developer documentation, it's, again, something that's very easy to implement. So if you've got an app and you want to share data over iCloud, I think you're going to see it happening very quickly. I think a lot of these app developers that make great Mac or iPad apps are going to suddenly be making for the other platforms so they can take advantage of it. But, you know, the big, you know, poster child for all this is the iWork apps, but they don't have a release yet on the Mac that fully takes advantage of this.
I don't have no idea what Apple was thinking on this side of things. Sorry. You know, this is the biggest faux pas when you're trying to push forward something like documents in the cloud, because yeah, you can sync between, say, your iPhone and your iPad, because you save something on the iPhone and then it shows up in the file system on the iPad. It works great, right? But then you go to your Mac, and I've had several people send me emails, and they're like, documents in the cloud isn't working for my Pages document. And you have to email them back and say, well, yeah, that's because it's not there. You have to go to iWork.com. Is it iWork.com? No, you have to go to your iCloud account and then to the iWork documents there, and you'll see it there, and you have to download the document, edit it on your Mac, and then if you want it back on your iPad, you have to re-upload it, right? Through the web interface.
It's crazy. And in my book, frankly, has text in there explaining how you can go to the Mac and get your document, because I was told by pretty good authority that, no, this is all going to release at the same time. Because you write these books, and they're going to come out with the iOS 5 release, and that part didn't arrive. And I don't know if it's coming any day now, or if something changed and they decided they're going to wait until iWork 2012 to release it, or 2013. It's kind of frustrating for me, because my book is inaccurate on that point. At this point, you cannot go to your Mac and easily get that document.
Yeah.
And so, I would like that to be fixed ASAP, but
I think a lot. Oh. I think a lot of us would. So really, Dropbox at the moment, I think, is the way to go if you need to do document syncing between any application on your Mac and, you know, on your iOS devices. As long as you those two, you know, as long as the app has integration with Dropbox, that's what I'm finding myself using more and more.
And Dropbox lets you go between different apps. So if you use Adobe Acrobat for PDFs on your PC and you use PDF Pen Pro on your Mac and GoodReader on your iPad, using Dropbox, you can use all those apps. The whole idea behind iCloud is it's a unified app on different platforms, which is a kind of a different way of looking at it.
Let me ask you about this whole push versus pull thing. And I'm still not 100% clear, and I'm hoping that maybe you know the answer to this, but with documents in the cloud, so I open Pages on my iPhone and I create a document and I put a couple little things in there, but it's really not, you know, the small screen kind of tricky to work with. I mean, you can kind of get some stuff done, but say I start a document there. I save it, documents in the cloud. I go to my iPad and it's there, right?
You go to your iPad and you open the app and right. It's there.
Yeah, I open the app and it's there.
There's a difference.
Well, yeah. But at the moment I open the app, it sucks it down. Whether yes. I'm going to be working on that document on my iPad or not.
Yes.
So that is one thing. It's a big difference between, I think, how Dropbox works on iOS and how Apple is planning documents in the cloud to work. And I kind of don't like the Apple method, because especially if I had a 16 gigabyte iPad and I was doing a lot of work with Pages documents, I mean, maybe it's not going to fill up that much, but if I don't plan on working on that document on my iPad, why do I need a copy of it on my iPad?
Because you've elected to hook that iPad to your iCloud, you know, wagons. But Adam, your complaint with that is very standard for a geek. A geek is going to say, why does it need to do that? Why can't I control that granularity? And the point is, there's a lot of people out there who are not geeks.
Yeah.
And you tell them, hey, you need to open a folder up and put it in there, and you need to create this folder called Dropbox, and, you know, we're going to open up the Finder, and their eyes roll back in their heads, and they just say, okay, well, I'll just get my USB key out and just copy it that way.
Yeah,
because
you're right.
The idea of dealing with the Finder and Dropbox and all this stuff just makes their head spin. So Apple found a way to do this that involves literally no user interaction whatsoever. You launch the app and it syncs.
Yeah. So you open up your Pages, and look, all my documents that I've ever worked on in Pages are there.
And when they get it working, and I believe they will, right, this is so important to this company that, and they realize that from everything I've seen, that once they get it working, there'll be many millions of people who would never consider Dropbox that take advantage of this.
Yeah.
That's just my prediction.
Yeah. And so the other point behind that, like I said, you know, you open Pages and all your Pages documents are there, right? The operating system is aware that these are Pages documents. They belong to Pages. They get opened in Pages. So they are in Pages. And in my talk, I you know, kind of played on the internet meme. And I said the philosophy of sort of document management on the iPad is, or on iOS, is all your files belong to us, you know, files with a Z. And you really need to wrap your head around that when you want to use the iPad as your sort of primary thing, and you're moving away from maybe a notebook or a laptop. You have to understand this concept that, you know, the document or the application owns the files to a certain degree. I mean, we have those things we already talked about, you know, getting familiar with that actions button so that you can do the whole open with to move between documents that can also deal with that file format. But sort of the application that you created in the originating application.
There you go. There I think the go. Third one nailed it. Yeah.
Is the one that kind of owns the document until you tell it, you know, to send it someplace else. And so OpenWith is your friend. Cloud storage is your friend for doing that sort of thing. But also just knowing that, you know, hey, document is going to live and be owned by the application that creates it.
Yes.
Yeah. And so once you start doing that, then it starts to make sense. And I think you're right. I think for geeks and nerds, that's a little bit unnerving. You know, it's like, what do you mean? But to the average person who is just using Pages, that makes perfect sense. And 90% of the time, they're probably not dealing with that document any other place than Pages. You know, maybe if they're going to print it, but they're just going to print out a hard copy. Or maybe if they're going to email a PDF version of that. But that's a one-off, right? You're going to hit that actions button. You're going to say email. It's going to generate a PDF because you're going to pick that format. And you're done with it. But when you want to come back and do an edit to that, well, you're going to go back to Pages. And lo and behold, there's your Pages document.
It could be really useful, and even us nerds may find that it has our attention and usefulness.
Yeah, and sort of related to this too, all of your supporting assets for applications like Pages, right, have their own applications. So the biggest one for me is Photos. You know, wrapping around your head around that. Hey, if I want to insert a photo or a graphic or something into my Pages document, well, that thing, I need to get it into the Photos app, and then I'll have that available to use. But your Photos app is sort of becomes your image manager, right?
And when you combine that with PhotoStream, it works pretty well. Yeah. If you're willing to take the picture with an Apple device. The walled garden is a nice place if you stay in the walled garden, as they say.
Exactly. Exactly.
I had an example last night. I was working. I'm giving a presentation at BlogWorld this year, and I wanted to do the slides. And I don't know if this is going to be a complete train wreck or not, but I didn't want bullet pointed slides, so I decided to draw my own diagrams for my slides. And I am not Jeff Gamet. Let's just be clear. But I thought, okay, so I drew some pictures using some of the drawing apps on the iPad. And as soon as you save it to the photo library, it immediately goes up to PhotoStream and then was appearing on Aperture on my Mac within seconds. And then I could do some further stuff on it and get it into the keynote presentation I was building on my Mac. And mm-hmm. It felt really great having that happen so fast.
Yeah, PhotoStream is kind of amazing. So, you know, by the same token, it's funny that I mentioned documents in the cloud bothers me that it sort of streams things, but... at the same time, I like that feature with PhotoStream. The fact that I take a photo on my iPhone and it's immediately on my iPad or immediately in iPhoto on my desktop is kind of a really cool thing.
Yeah. And there's some complications. You can't remove selectively photos, which doesn't make a lot of sense, but it's a 1.0.
So oh, yeah, we'll from the stream. Yeah, a lot of people are complaining about that you can't just... take something out of the stream itself or hide. You know, I think most people would probably just want to be able to, say hide this within the stream is probably all that's really needed most of the time. But
I'm not sure I really care yet. With respect to PhotoStream, I'm just looking at it as a place to grab photos out of and put somewhere. I'm not looking at it as an album itself, but right. I can get that too. I'm so old that my life is boring enough that I don't really have any pictures that I must get out of my photo stream.
Right. So when you were saying you were doing the diagram drawing apps, are you talking about strictly, drawing like with the tool like OmniGraffle, or are you talking about like some of the actual painting programs?
I was using Sketchbook Pro for this one.
Okay, cool.
I wanted to talk about the Merlin Mann has this great quote that, starting a blog to make money is like learning magic tricks to pick up girls. And I thought that was really funny, but I think it also applies to podcasts. So, and I'm doing a session on getting sponsors. So I drew a picture of a magic hat with a rabbit, and wow, I don't know if anybody's ever going to see it. I have to give it a couple of days.
Let me ask you this. Did you draw that picture with your finger?
I used a stylus.
Okay.
I'm not a big fan of styluses, but I found one that I kind of like. And
The reason I'm doing this to you is because I'm creating my own lead-in for the next section I want to talk about. Because
all right,
the next thing to me in getting your iPad to kind of work for you is that Steve was 100% wrong in my opinion when he said that the finger is the best input device. I think it is for certain tasks, but it's not always the best input device. So I think if you're really looking to use your iPad to do content creation and get work done, in certain situations, you have to accessorize. You need to use some other input devices, a stylus being one of those things, right? If you need to do drawing apps, you know, your finger just is not most people's fingers. I mean, unless you have teeny tiny, really pointy fingers, or you whittle them down, like has been talked about, it's not the most precise thing, right?
Yeah. So I use the Pogo Sketch Pro.
Yeah, I just got one of these. I really like it.
It's got a tapered design. It's got a nice balance to it. I like it.
Yeah, and the tip's a little bit kind of more accurate. I can see underneath it a little bit better than the sort of spongy one. You know, it's more of that kind of rubberized capacitive tip. They actually give you both, I think, but I only use the little rubberized one.
Yeah, there's several accessories I talked about in the book that I think are important. A Bluetooth keyboard, if you're going to do a lot of serious typing, is pretty useful.
Yeah, you know, I was just at a conference. It was funny. I was at a conference this week, and a guy had brought his Apple Bluetooth keyboard and was kind of an iPad and was taking notes. That's all he had with him. What was funny was he had the iPad open, right, and he had his note app up, and he had the keyboard literally right on top of the screen. So okay. he wasn't even looking at the screen. You know, he was just typing away, and whatever he was typing was going on underneath. I had never seen that before, but I thought, you know, that works. I mean,
yeah, it does. I like the Apple Bluetooth keyboard. It's a nice size. They have folding keyboards, which are pretty neat, but the Apple one has a much better feel than those folding keyboards. They're pretty mushy, in my experience.
Yeah. Well, and then some of the keyboard cases, like the one from Zag, which I think Logitech is now OEM'd, right? The Zagmate keyboard,
yeah.
Which is nice because you get a hard shell case so you can protect your device, and then you've got the keyboard kind of built into half the tray, and it's got a nice little stand so you can kind of prop it up like a laptop. There's also some clamshell designs with Bluetooth keyboards built in. So, I mean, you have a lot of options if you want to sort of, you know, make your iPad into this kind of convertible, you know, tablet sort of thing, or I mean, notebook thing. Kind of thing.
Another good accessory if you travel a lot. I don't use this very often, but when I'm spending a lot of times on planes, it's nice to have it in my bag, is one of these HyperMac mini batteries that basically gives you another day of iPad use.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
The iPad battery generally is good enough. After 10 hours, I'm ready to stop looking at screens. Right?
Yeah, it pretty much lasts as long as you want. But I mean, if you know you're going someplace that's really remote, you're going to be away from any place to kind of plug in, and it doesn't hurt. And those batteries are pretty small, pretty easy to throw into a bag and still not add a lot of bulk.
Yeah, the way I do all the accessories for my iPad, I do carry my Pogo Sketch Pro with me. But the keyboard, the battery, the cables to hook it up to a projector, all that stuff, I have a little box I keep it in. And then I selectively pack those things as I need them.
Well, and then we didn't even talk about, I mean, we need to talk about what I consider the ultimate must-have, you no questions asked accessory.
What's that?
The Apple camera connection kit.
Yes, it is. It's like the Swiss Army knife of the iPad.
You gotta have that thing. You know, and if for nothing else, if you have an iPhone or an iPod Touch and you need to get photos in there into your iPad, the iPad camera sucks. I'm sorry. There's just no ways about it. I mean, it's okay if you just need to take something maybe for a comp or something like that. But if you want a photo that you're going to use in your Pages document or your Keynote presentation or something like that, yeah, you can probably get away with it. But if you want a better picture, grab your iPhone, snap it, you know, hook in the camera connection kit USB dongle and plug in your docking cable, suck those photos right into your iPad. Although now with PhotoStream, it happens automatically. So maybe that's less useful, but maybe you have an older one. I don't know. Maybe you haven't upgraded to iOS 5.
Yeah,
I have it. You're not using iCloud.
And there's a lot of things that plug into it that surprise you. There's hard drives that can go in there and USB thumb drives. Not always, but usually the limiting factor is the amount of power that they draw. Yeah. They don't draw a lot of power. Even some microphones work with it.
Microphones, USB keyboards, yeah. MIDI. I plugged in my MIDI keyboard through the USB connector. I just have one of the little M-Audio ones, you know, the, I think it's 49E or something like that. It's called 49-key keyboard. Fired up GarageBand on the iPad. It works awesome.
Yeah, I love that. I use my iPad as my MIDI capture device because I have a Yamaha full 88-key keyboard that I don't have room in my house for a piano. And I like being able to play the piano with my headphones on. So, because I like to play Thelonious Monk, and it makes my rest of my family crazy. So I put it through headphones. But now I can plug in my iPad with this camera connection kit to the MIDI, capture the MIDI on the iPad, then just go send it to GarageBand or to Logic on my Mac and go nuts. It's great.
It's just really, really awesome. And then, you know, again, the camera connection kit, if you have a nice digital point-and-shoot camera, the iPad is some really amazing, great applications for doing photo processing and photo editing. You know, my current favorite is Snapseed from Nix Software. And I used to work for Nix Software. I didn't when they brought out the app, but I immediately downloaded it and was just blown away by what
I didn't know they had an iPad app. I'm going to have to look that up right now.
Oh, you don't have Snapseed?
No. What's wrong with me?
You are going to be thoroughly amazed. The thing about Snapseed is they really thought out the user interface. And I think this goes back to the earlier conversation, right? Of you have to rethink the iPad as a computer. It is a computer, but it is a different kind of computer, and it demands a different type of interaction, a different type of usage pattern, a different workflow. And once you accept that, then it becomes really easy to start using it in very powerful ways and to get, quote, real work done.
Yeah.
You know, and that's all it takes. And it's not a steep learning curve. I mean, once you do it, it's kind of like you almost want, in some ways, the Mac to work that way in certain situations, which I think is why we're getting this sort of round tripping of features, right? Pulling in kind of the features that make sense from iOS onto the Mac and vice versa.
But it's interesting. Yeah, I think about it sometimes in terms of the original Mac and when we had this transition from the keyboard and terminal that, you know, we were looking at with the Apple II. And then the Mac came out and it felt like the world changed. And all of us guys that were there then now like to reminisce about those days, about how much it was different. I remember for me, the thing that got me with the first Mac was the preferences pane, as silly as that sounds. And you would have like mouse clicks and it would have a tortoise and a hare for faster and slower. And it just blew my mind that someone would go to that level for a computer, because there was nothing ever like that before. I feel the same way about the iPad. And I think all of us that are exploring the iPad now are going to look at these days fondly as the iPad becomes a much bigger, or just tablet computers in general, become a much bigger part of our lives.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And then another thing that I think people forget about, because it's a relatively new feature, again, an important one for a lot of people's workflows, is printing.
Yeah.
You know, I think Canon just released new print. Was it Canon who was out first? No, HP was out first with their ePrint line, and then Canon just had a whole new line of printers come out that have built-in direct support for printing from iPads and iPhones. Yes. And then if you don't have that, I am a huge fan of Printopia.
Yeah.
Which
I haven't bought a printer, an iOS-friendly printer, because Printopia works so great. But the next time I get a printer, it's definitely going to have the iOS support.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. But with Printopia, I mean, just about any printer. I hooked up an old Canon Selfie, you know, one of these little portable printers.
Yeah.
And it works great. So the way Printopia works is basically any printer on your home network that your Mac can print to. So if you have it hooked into, like I have one hooked into an Airport Express base station, or directly connected via USB to your Mac, you run Printopia, which is a system preference pane on your Mac, and then you add those printers to Printopia's list, and then they will show up and be made available through your home network to your iOS devices. And it not only allows you to print directly to the printer, but the other big thing is if you have Dropbox, you know, going back to Dropbox, you can print directly into Dropbox. And I've used that before just to get something off my iPad into a PDF format and onto my Mac, especially when the application maybe doesn't have direct support for exporting to PDF. It might only do, you know, printing. So you can print straight into Dropbox, which is just kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
And then it shows up everywhere. And then any other application I can that has Dropbox access, like GoodReader, I can pull that PDF then into GoodReader. Kind of cool.
Round trip.
So you kind of get used to these workflows. You know, that's the thing, is you start to discover when you kind of open your mind to how the iPad works and how things flow, you can create these workflows and figure out a process that sort of works for you. And then I guess closing out, the last thing I want to talk to you about is, you know, remembering that the Mac and the iPad kind of work really well together. I mean, you can do the file system stuff through iTunes and a lot of applications. So if you need to get your GarageBand file out of GarageBand on the iPad and back onto your Mac, you kind of go through the iTunes system. But another powerful way that the Mac helps me with my iPad is through remote access.
Yeah.
So
which app do you use for that?
I use a couple different ones. I think by far the easiest to set up and get integrated is LogMeIn Ignition.
Very good app.
Yeah. I think it's a little, you know, it's 15, I think 15 bucks is what I paid, you know, and then you get the free account on the desktop side, but you don't have to, I found that with that, I didn't have to worry about firewall configuration. I didn't have to do a lot of fancy stuff in terms of, because it does the whole registration thing. You know, basically you run.
And it lets you browse the file system on the source computer, which is something most of them don't do.
Yeah, exactly. And that's very powerful, because I find that most often the reason I need to remote control my Mac is to get some sort of file that I didn't have in my Dropbox into my Dropbox. And yeah, with LogMeIn Ignition, you don't have to do that, because you can just go straight to the file system and then you can do the open in thing and send it to one of your supported applications for that document type.
Yeah. Yeah. I gave that app a lot of words in the book, because I felt it was really the premier remote access app. I tried several of them, and this is the one that anybody can set up.
Yep.
Pretty quickly and reliably depend upon. It's a great app.
Yeah, that's just the thing. I mean, I'm a nerd and a geek and a command line guy, so I do manage servers because I'm a web developer, and so I need just pure SSH sometimes, you know, secure shell, and I use ISSH for that, and that'll also do VNC remote access if you know how to kind of configure and set that up. I mean, that's built into the Mac. You just go into the sharing settings and the remote access stuff, and you can turn on VNC. And so I'll use that. I also have iTeleport kind of for the same reason. But that took some doing, right? I had to set up Dyn DNS to handle the dynamic IP address that is assigned by my cable provider. I had to open up ports and you know, for security reasons, change port numbers and the tunneling. I mean, it gets really technical in terms of the setup if you want to set it up right and securely. Whereas with LogMeIn Ignition, that's kind of all handled for you.
Yes. Another good one is remote desktop RDC supported apps. You know, because if you've got a Microsoft Windows setup at work, you want to be able to get into the RDC. And there's a couple apps that I think are good for that.
So what ones do you use for that?
You know, I'm looking right now. The name escapes me. Just give me a minute here.
I think one of the ones that I have supports that. I can't remember. I can't remember if it's iTeleport or ISSH, but I'm pretty sure I have one remote access app that supports RDC. I don't remember which one. But again, you know, it's sort of like I'd almost fall back on, I think LogMeIn Ignition supports remote access to the PC, not through RDC, but through its own through the LogMeIn software.
But if your work requires you to go through RDC, the one I like is Jump Desktop, J-U-M-P.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I mean, and that comes in handy when, you know, for those few times where maybe you forgot to turn on a service. You know, I found I've used it for another great, although this is more just on the entertainment side rather than the work side, but for watching videos, I have Air Video.
Yeah.
And I will sometimes have forgotten to leave the Air Video server on my Mac, and so I can use Log Me In, dive in there, turn on the server, and then get access to, you know, stream my videos from my Mac to Air Video when I'm out and about somewhere.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And maybe you don't want to leave it on all the time for whatever reason. You might have some services you don't want to leave on all the time. You can just get back into your Mac and do something like that. So those are the two times I found I'm doing kind of remote access.
Yeah. And when you have the situation where you absolutely must track changes or must get into a pivot table Excel spreadsheet at work, or you must get into, you know, QuickBooks or something that's on a PC, this will do it. It's not recommended that you live there, but in a pinch, it'll work just fine.
Yeah, it's funny how many things that you can kind of do in a pinch, and maybe even beyond that. Like, again, being a programmer and a web developer, I'm exploring, you know, how much can I do with writing code and accessing servers and managing sort of the things that I normally do on my desktop. And I don't think it's quite there yet, but I mean, there's some great applications, and some of it's because of Apple's own limitations in terms of, you know, I can't run PHP on my iPad yet. So I can't build a website in using PHP and then preview it or test it on the iPad. I have to get it up to a server somewhere. But I can use an application like Textastic, which has great code highlighting and SFTP support, you know, secure FTP support, and I can write something in there, a PHP program. I can upload it to my server using SFTP built right into the application, and then I can pop open Safari, you know, switch over to Safari using the multi-switcher, what do we call that thing? Multitask manager, and test it, right?
Yeah. And the interesting thing, Adam, is all these limitations we talk about, it's just a question of processing speed and hardware limitations. And this guy named Moore said that that's going to get fixed pretty soon, right?
It's true. It's true. I want to give another mention, you know, for the geeks out there, because this just came up this weekend. I had something happened with my calendars, and this is a whole nother conversation, but I've been kind of having some iCloud issues. I think we're going to talk about this maybe on the MacCast members show. But I had missed a reminder. I was supposed to send this report, and I have the SQL report, you know, that I pulled directly out of my database that I needed to run, and I need to send this Excel file with this data to one of my clients. And I was at this conference, and I get a phone call, and they're like, "Hey, where's that report?" I went, "Oh, you know, expletive." And I had decided that day that I wasn't going to bring my laptop, and that I was just going to use my iPad because it was kind of inconvenient, and they didn't have Wi-Fi at this conference for whatever reason. And I went, "Oh man, what am I going to do?" But there was a Starbucks around the corner, and I had this MySQL application on my iPad. And I went, "You know, I bet you I could use that." And the reason I got this app is because it also supports secure shell tunneling, so SSH tunneling, so it's secure. I can get in and I can, you know, connect to the SQL server and I can run a SQL query. And so I did that, and then it has export to CSV file directly into Numbers. So, you know, in a matter of minutes, I ran down to Starbucks, I ran the query that I needed to run, exported it out to Numbers, did some quick formatting, did the whole share thing, shared an email, emailed the client the document, and it was done. And I did it all on my iPad. You know, yeah. I did not need my Mac. I wouldn't say it was as easy, but I had never really done it before. You know, I had these applications and I kind of played around with them, but there's a great example where I used it for real work, getting real work done in something that I normally would have done all on my Mac, but I did it all on my iPad this time.
Yeah, I had an experience like that today as well. I went into a conference room. I gave a keynote presentation to about 30 people using an iPad and an Apple TV and shut the lid and walked out the door. I didn't have any cords, any Macs, any remotes, any of that stuff. It was pretty remarkable.
So, you know, I think kind of in summary, I think what we can say is that it's really just about sort of changing mindsets. And I think to a certain degree, like we've alluded to in this episode, nerds have a harder time than people who are new to the iPad and don't have any preconceived ideas about how things should work or are meant to work or how we think they were meant to work. But for the rest of us, you know, I think if we just stop for a minute and accept the iPad for what it is and then explore its capabilities rather than trying to impose limitations on it and limitations on ourselves, that's how we discover that this is really a device for, you know, getting work done.
Yes.
I
agree.
And I think that's, you know, that's a lot of what, I mean, we touched on some of the things that you cover in the book, and, you know, this was basically the gist of my presentation, but there is a whole lot more. How big is the book? How many pages?
It's 24 chapters. I think it's 360 some pages.
Yeah. And so we've only kind of scratched the surface of this stuff, I think. Yeah.
The book is laid out in a nice way. It has a chapter on each relevant subject. So if you want to work on presentations, there's a presentation chapter. If you want to work on calculators and spreadsheets, there's a chapter for that. If you want to work on security or remote access and some of the stuff we talked about, each one has its own chapter. So you don't have to go digging, you know, to find the nuggets. You can say, okay, I want to figure out how to deal with this remote access stuff Adam was talking about. Well, you go through that chapter, it has the best apps recommended and how to use them and how to set them up. And by the time you finish that chapter, you know all you need to know to get remote access. And then maybe you don't care about spreadsheets, but you really care about presentations. You could read that chapter or PDF. So yep. It's written in a way that is user-friendly. And it has QR codes, so you can jump to the apps right in the App Store using your iPad, or in the iBook Store version, you can just tap the link and it'll bring you to the link. So it's a very user-friendly book. I'm really proud of it.
Yeah, it's really great, and I'm glad you mentioned the whole QR code thing, because I thought that was a brilliant idea, and it's one of the first books where I've seen that implemented, because you do have a lot of links. And I know a question I get asked a lot when, you know, I'm having conversations with people is, oh, what apps do you use? Everybody wants to know the apps, and you've made it incredibly easy for someone to just take their iPhone, take one of the little scanner apps, Red Laser, or, you know, I use the AT&T one even now, that sort of built in, anything that'll read a QR code, point the phone at it, and boom, you're right there on the App Store ready to grab that app. So
I got a very funny email from a reader saying, I love your book, my wife hates it because I keep going and buying apps.
Yeah. So you should buy the book. It might end up costing you more in the long run, but you're going to have a lot of powerful apps at the end of it on your devices, and you're going to know how to use them, you know?
And if you want to, if you're a worker and you want to be at the vanguard of what I consider to be a major shift in the way we work, why not get good at it? You know, be one of the leaders. There's actually a lot of people using my book to teach classes. I'm getting lots of emails from teachers.
Oh, that's
so
awesome.
It's kind of exciting to hear about that.
Well, very, very cool. So you can check it out. It's on Amazon, the iBook Store. Is it in stores?
Yes, it's in stores. It's got real wide distribution. So if you have a Barnes & Noble or a brick-and-mortar bookstore, you can probably go find it next to your house. If you like to read ebooks, I prefer the iBook version. I think they're the same price as we record this. Like I said, the iBooks supports links. So when you're reading the iBook version, you can tap a link and jump to the web or jump to the App Store, where the Kindle doesn't support that. So,
oh, interesting. I didn't know
that. But if you're a Kindle reader, there is a Kindle version as well. So whatever works.
So lots of ways to get that. You can find David at MacSparky.com and also on Mac Power Users. How often do you do the show?
It looks like 3 a month. We're kind of expanding a little bit right now.
Okay.
So we used to be 2. Now we're moving it up to 3, maybe more.
I couldn't remember if you had transitioned or not. So check that out on 5x5. And David, thanks for coming and hanging out with us, talking to us a little bit about actually, you know, doing real stuff on your iPads, which I think most of us have been doing for a while. But it's, you know, it's good. It serves as a good reminder, and you know, go out and explore, have fun with the thing, and really use it for, you know, other things beyond web and email.
It's always a pleasure speaking with you, Adam. Thank you for having me.
It's always a pleasure to have David on the show as well. David is a really smart guy, and hopefully that sparks your interest. And yes, the pun was intended there. I know it's bad, but I couldn't resist. At least piques your interest in finding out a little bit more about the capabilities of the iPad, what you can do with it, what different applications you can use to transition it from just a content consumption device to a content creation device. And I think the key, as you heard there, is to really rethink what the iPad is and what it can do for you, and just start exploring. I mean, think about the kinds of applications that you'd like to use your iPad for, and try and figure out if you can actually do those things. And I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised once you start digging in. And I'm sure this episode is probably piqued your interest, and maybe you have some questions, some things that you'd like to ask me or even David. I mean, feel free to email David. He's a great guy and very receptive to questions. And you'll find him, like I said, over at MacSparky.com over on Mac Power Users. But that's going to do it for the episode for today. Before I leave you, I do want to thank all of my show sponsors. Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their stuff and get more information and details over at Phoronix.com. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. Check out their application. Get information, details, as well as trials over at CircusPonies.com. Smile. Check out Text Expander. Also, PDF Pen Disk Label. Don't forget, you can get 20% off if you just go to SmileSoftware.com/MacCast. 20% off PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro. And while you're there, check out their other great applications. They do have trials available. And Gazelle, if you're thinking about an upgrade to maybe a new iPhone, new iPod, you want to get some cash for your older electronics and devices, it can be a digital video camera, an iPod, an iPhone. They have an ever-growing list of products that they will give you cash for. Just do a simple search over at gazelle.com and get cash for your used stuff. Quick and easy. And big thank you to all of my show sponsors for their support of the MacCast. As I mentioned at the top of the show, lots of questions flying in about iOS 5, about iCloud, about the iPhone 4S. We're going to get to all of those on a future episode of the MacCast. If you want to get your question in related to any of that, or maybe some of the stuff in this episode piqued your interest, applications for that you can use on your iPad or your iOS devices, send those along. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com, and I welcome email questions. I also really welcome audio questions. If you want to attach an audio file, if you want to use the audio recorder on your iOS device to email in a question, that would be great. We can play those on the show. And if you want to do it even easier, you can call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. That's just a voicemail address, so you can call in on that. Leave a voicemail message. And if you're in another country, you want to save on some long distance charges, and you're on Skype, you can use the Skype address. My Skype name is The MacCast. And if I'm not online, you can just leave a voicemail there. Even if I'm online, just text me ahead of time and say, hey, I want to leave a voicemail message, and I won't pick up the call. And then you can leave voicemail there. I look forward to hearing your comments and your questions. And be sure to check out the website. MacCast.com is the address. There you can find show notes to most of the episodes, and also check out the MacCast forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. And just so you know, the Facebook page I use to kind of post interesting things, a lot of video links to articles and stuff that I find as I'm doing my research. So sometimes there's stuff that is just kind of fun and quirky, might not make it into the show. A great place to follow on that stuff is over on the MacCast Facebook page. So check that out. And I know I haven't played new music on the MacCast in a while. That's mainly because people just aren't sending it in. So if you're in a band, you have an album, maybe on iTunes, something that you want people to take a listen to, please send that along. Also, I just need permission and a piece of album art that I can include in the show, and I'm happy to play that stuff and help promote your band or whatever project you might be working on. And to that end, actually, I received an email from Daphne, who's done some Mac-related, Apple-related music in the past. And with the passing of Steve Jobs, she reminded me that she has a sort of Apple history song out there. Rapple History is the name of the track, and I think I played it on the MacCast in the past, but I thought I'd just close out the show today because it's kind of fun and quirky, and it really does cover a lot of Apple's history. So take a listen. Here's Rapple History, and until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.
Upon a time there came together two minds. They were both called Steven. With their talents would achieve a real milestone in technology, the first personal computer in our history. It was 1976, the price 666. They built 200 in all, but soon the first Apple would fall to make way for the next. A new machine with more finesse, but there was just one catch, and that was how to get the cash. And Mark Kula, he co-signed a loan. Thus was born Apple Computer, and a third of it he owned.
Going back, it's all you ever want to own. Put your mind in the zone. Once you get a Mac, there's never going back. It's all you ever want to own. Put your mind in the zone. Zone.
There were problems down the line. It was a turbulent time. There was unrest in the ranks and tribulation with the banks. 1984, Apple was breaking down the door to make a comeback. With something called the Mac, they got a hold of it and spot and bought a Super Bowl spot. It was a marketing smash, innovative new splash, and things really got cozy when it hooked up with Adobe. Was a perfect kind of match. DTP would patch. Stevie got out of line, things were getting real crazy. He was asked to resign from his own company. How could that be? But it really did happen, and I hope no one's laughing. He was feeling quite dejected from having been rejected, but it soon turned out to be the thing that helped to set him free to buy Pixar and found the company next. He was doing what he loved, and it was all for the best. From the Apple number two came forth the Apple IIc, and then the Apple IIg, and the Mac Pack was its own family, with the Mac Plus 2 SE, the Classic, and the LC. PowerBook in 1991 was a landmark product. A new chapter had begun. Apple was doing really well, everybody feeling swell, but they needed to upset the IBM PC threat, so they came out with a quarter, the Centris and Performer, but they didn't do so well. They lost a lot of clientele. At IBM's door came the Power Macintosh. It was a beauty, oh my gosh. And the Newton, the first PDA. It didn't do so great, but the idea was here to stay. Then in 1996, they were in need of a fix, so they brought the Steve back to get the Apple on track and bought his company next. It would become the new OS. They made him CEO. He was in charge of the show. It was a real fine move. It would help to prove that he had all it would take to reclaim the Apple state. Yeah.
Once you get a Mac, there's never going back. It's all you ever want to own. Put your mind in the zone. Once you get a Mac, there's never going back. It's all you ever want to own. Put your mind in the zone.
It was a real Mac attack. The Mac was getting on track. Sophisticated comeback. And came the iBook and the Power Mac G4. Everybody take a look. How about the new Airport? 2001, enter the Mac OS 10. What a beautiful thing. Well, you can say that again. Behold the iPod, PowerBook, the Power Mac G5. It was clear for all to see Apple was very much alive. They got their very own star. They'd never had one before. Now they could get with the biz. Well, you know how it is. apples right at the core of a new age of the music and the way we're gonna use it. And it's growing by the day as a revolutionary way to get your movies and TV shows, podcasts, and videos. Looking swell, Macintels, boot camp, and parallels. Pulling out the masses from the Microsoft molasses. What's on Apple TV? Everything you wanna see that's on your Mac or your PC, now it's on the big screen. iWork, iLife, everything to make it fun to digitize, harmonize, capitalize, and organize. iPhone, Apple's done it again. This pioneering product gets a 10 out of 10. It's a household name. Things will never be the same. Just one more thing to say. Apple Inc. is here to stay.
Yeah. Once again, a Mac, there's never going back. It's all you ever want to own. Put your mind in the zone. Once again, a Mac, there's never going back. It's all you ever want to own. Put your mind in the zone.
Once again, a Mac, no going back. Once again, a Mac.